Do you know a high school student who would make a great pastor, teacher, deaconess, director of parish music, or director of Christian education? Tell them about Careers for Christ Weekend, Friday, October 12th through Sunday, October 14th at Concordia University, Chicago. This even includes a group outing to downtown Chicago. Check it out at cuchicago.edu/c4c. That's cuchicago.edu/c4c.
Roe v. Wade is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. It's been reaffirmed many times.
The purpose of assisted suicide is to eliminate suffering. And they are also saying eliminating the sufferer is an acceptable way to do that.
I think it's exceedingly myopic and narcissistic to think that the church is that fluid, that it changes so quickly with the times.
He joins himself to us again and again in the Holy Communion as one flesh with him. He is to us everything. Everything that Adam should have been to Eve, and even more.
Hi, this is Nick from Washington State, and I'm a carpenter who loves to listen to Issues, etc.
It is something that we simply kind of take for granted. It's always been there, hasn't it? Always been this way, that priests in the Roman Catholic Church are celibate. They do not marry. Some would say they cannot marry. Is it a tradition? Is it a church law? Is it a self-imposed discipline, or one imposed by the church on men who would be priests? What is the history of priestly celibacy? And what does it have to do with marriage and the early church's view of virginity? We're going to be answering some of those questions that we look at a history of celibacy and the priesthood. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Tuesday afternoon from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. James Buescher will be our guest for the first 45 minutes of the program as we do part one of a history on priestly celibacy. Carol Tobias, president of National Right to Life, will join us after that. We'll get a response to a Slate column titled "The Judicial Assault on Roe v. Wade Has Begun." It asserts that in the lower courts, there are judges who've been waiting their entire careers to start, well, either upholding or turning down laws that either go against or favor Roe v. Wade. Is this true? And we'll see what's going to happen if Brett Kavanaugh is actually confirmed in the next seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Carol Tobias will be our guest. We'll go through a little listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line, and then Dr. Adam Francisco will join us for a beginning of a series on the Quran, the holy book, or one of the holy books of Islam. We're going to be talking about Surah 9, a key place to begin on the 17th anniversary of the attacks, the terrorist attacks on 9/11. He's author of the book Martin Luther and Islam. Joining us to begin a short series on the history of celibacy in the Roman Catholic priesthood in the Western Church, Dr. James Buescher. He's Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Buescher, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Todd.
If someone wanted to assert that the, for lack of a better word, the enforced celibacy of the priesthood as we see it in the Roman Catholic Church today is an apostolic tradition going all the way back to the time of the apostles, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question and certainly a very relevant one to our own day. Certainly, I would say, especially in the way that you asked that question, the first answer is certainly no. The idea of an enforced celibacy, I don't think we see that. Now, of course, the history is a bit more complicated. There's no doubt is a certain elevation of the virginal life of in the early church generally, but the idea of an enforced absolute celibacy as we kind of hear it today, that is the norm of single priests who are celibate their whole lives, that's something that I think comes in and becomes the norm more recently with the Middle Ages. But in the early church, I think, you know, we do have to recognize the very important place that the virginal life, virginity, had in the early church. Certainly, we can recognize even some of the seeds of this in early Christianity. Even in Jesus' day, you know, the norm is that rabbis tend to reject any idea of celibacy. And certainly, procreation was at the center of Jewish identity and the Jewish family. But there was certainly something distinctive about Christianity when we have Jesus, who's born of a virgin, who lives the virginal life himself, John the Baptist, who was an example of that, certainly the example of Paul. And then we have certain scriptural texts that highlight kind of the virginal life. Maybe the most important of those is something like Matthew 22:30, in which Jesus says and points out that the marriage life is not an eternal one, right? And he says that in the resurrection, you will neither marry nor be given in marriage. And so it certainly was part of the early church that the virginal life is kind of the eschatological life, the life of the resurrection. And so it is elevated to a place of prominence. But it gets more complicated when we start talking about how that is applied to this fallen world and to the church and to the priestly vocation generally.
So let's talk a little bit about, it's not exactly the same thing, virginity and celibacy, but why virginity took on such a elevated place in the early church.
Yeah, I think, just kind of picking up where we just left off there a little bit with Matthew 22, that we have this sense from Jesus himself, and I think in the scriptures, that when the incarnation happens, when Christ comes into our world, he now brings with him a kingdom, the kingdom of the heavens, an eschatological kingdom, which in some sense transcends all the orders of this world. So that maybe the easiest way to kind of talk about this is therefore to enter the fellowship of the church now sees themselves as a new family, the family of God, in which a family and a family bonds that really transcend all of our earthly bonds, so that when you enter the fellowship of the church, when you're baptized, rich and poor, the status of rich and poor no longer means anything. The status of slave and free no longer means anything. Circumcision, uncircumcision doesn't mean anything. And even our familial, our natural familial bonds are transcended when we come into the presence of Christ, so that we now have God as our Father. When husband and wives came into the church, men typically sat with men and women with women, and they were seen now as brothers and sisters, with Christ as the only true bridegroom, the church as the bride, and, of course, as one family with our Father. So that sense of the fellowship of the church as a manifestation in this world of the world to come, of the kingdom of the heavens, certainly elevated the virginal life as an expression of that. Now, I guess what I'd also say is in the early church, I do think we always have to recognize that therefore, you always have this balance, and I always think this is, to me, the hallmark of this early period, is this balance between the marriage life as well as the virginal life as both good paths, as both certainly good and beneficial to one another. And I think that balance in the fact that they reject the extremes of, say, the Gnostics, who were rejecting marriage as well as they were rejecting other extremes of somebody like Jovinian, who seem to reject the ascetic life in any sense, that the church is always going to try to balance those two. And I think that, to me, is maybe the most interesting characteristic, that for the early church, therefore, marriage is meant to serve, shall we say, the purity of the virginal life, right? That may sound strange, but if in marriage the two become one, for the early church, the one that the two become is a virginal one. It is a pure one, right? So even a marriage was seen as the forsaking of all others for this one that God has given me. And we might even say the converse is true. Virginity is always preparation for marriage. That is especially the true marriage between Christ and the church, so that both marriage and virginity kind of were interdependent. They weren't mutually exclusive. And I think that's part of the challenge for us today, is we kind of think of marriage and virginity as being mutually exclusive and kind of separate from one another. Whereas in the early church, they kind of were seen as together, kind of mutually interdependent.
Is it safe to say that, to kind of use a Martin Luther term, a term he preferred, that chastity outside of marriage and chastity with inside marriage. Marriage was designed to guard chastity, obviously, with a sexual partner, and virginity was chastity outside of marriage.
Exactly. I think there you see kind of the common element that both are meant to be ways in which we do battle with sin and do battle with the devil. And I think that's kind of the recognition that you have in the early church that maybe starts to get lost in the Middle Ages. Whereas, yes, maybe the virginal life is and the chaste life is the manifestation of the resurrection. It's the eschatological kingdom. Where we get into problems is when you try to take that life of the resurrection, that eschaton, and try to make it present in this world, in a fallen world, where we still struggle with the weaknesses of our flesh, the passions of our flesh. In this fallen world, we need both, right? Marriage, as Paul himself puts it in 1 Corinthians 7, marriage is a very good remedy against sin in this fallen world, right? That we are, in this fallen world, slaves to our passions. We can't get rid of these desires. And marriage is a very good support of righteousness, of chastity, as you say. And so that husband and wife can support one another in that life of chastity together with one another. And so, yes, both of them therefore serve the same end of this purity of our life in Christ, which finally is only perfected in the resurrection and in the world to come.
Dr. James Buscher is our guest on this Tuesday, September the 11th. We are talking about the history of celibacy and the priesthood. When we come back, does the early church ever speak officially on the issue of priestly celibacy? Stay tuned.
Do you know a high school student who would make a great pastor, teacher, deaconess, director of parish music, or director of Christian education? Tell them about Careers for Christ Weekend, Friday, October 12th through Sunday, October 14th at Concordia University, Chicago. This even includes a group outing to downtown Chicago. Check it out at cuchicago.edu/c4c. That's cuchicago.edu/c4c.
Let's face it, no matter how hard you try to squeeze everything in, there are never enough hours in the day. If this struggle sounds familiar, you won't want to miss the September issue of the Lutheran Witness on time and limitations. With contributions from Jonathan Fisk, Brian Katchelmeyer, and others, this issue of the magazine will help you gain a heart of wisdom as you learn to number your days. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Historic, authentic Christian radio. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. James Buscher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. James Buscher is our guest. We are beginning a short series with him on the history of celibacy and the priesthood. He's Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Buscher, does the church in her early centuries ever speak officially on the issue of priestly celibacy?
Yeah, you do get certainly expressions of the way this, you know, highlighting of the virginal life now applies to the priesthood in different ways, like the Didascalia Apostolorum of the early 3rd century. You get testimony to these kinds of things, as well as some early synods like a council in Carthage in 390. But all of them, in my opinion, the way I read these texts is that I think the norm is that priests are married. I think that is the norm. Even if the virginal life is seen as the ideal and the eschatological life after the resurrection, still in this world, most of your priests in reality are married. I think in the Didascalia, it assumes that bishops are married. Now, it seems that the practice was that these married priests then practiced periodic continence. That is to say that the abstinence on the part of priests was very much tied to their ministration, their service at the altar and the doing of the Lord's Supper, very much tied to the Eucharistic gathering. So that just like the Mosaic Law, you had priests, you know, in Leviticus, Exodus, who were supposed to abstain from the sexual union while they are ministering at the altar. Christians generally took that same kind of perspective, that priests probably on Saturday and Sunday, those days generally are kind of talked about as being devoted to God, right? And you're to abstain during those days as a priest, as you serve at the altar and in prayer. And so that seems to me to be kind of the norm. Now, where you start to get the notion of a more prolonged celibacy and an absolute celibacy, maybe, you know, this is conjecture a little bit on my part, but maybe a difference between East and West here a little bit, that the East really didn't practice daily communion or daily Eucharist. The Eucharist was typically attached to Sunday. And so, you know, from the Eastern perspective, it was normal for married priests to then practice a periodic kind of continence or abstinence on Saturday, Sunday as they're ministering at the altar. Whereas in the West, you start to get daily Eucharistic celebration. And so you are starting to get testimonies from people like Tertullian in the West, Hippolytus and others, who are basically maintaining, you know, I mean, if you're having communion every day, then, you know, abstinence becomes perpetual and every day. And so some of the seeds of the extreme form start to kind of show up there. But I think in the early church, you basically have this practice of celibacy or this practice of continence by married priests that is more periodic, related to their administering of the Eucharist as well as perhaps penitential seasons and that kind of thing. As Paul had kind of mentioned in 1 Corinthians 7, that you may abstain for a season, right, and then come back together again.
With respect to the virginity and the celibacy, you also make mention of several extremes that are rejected. One you mentioned before, the Jovinian position, which we'll talk about in a minute. But first, what about Gnosticism?
Yeah, certainly you had certain extreme sects within the Christian church, certainly claiming to be Christian in the second century. And some of these, maybe most notoriously the Encratites, who in their kind of maintaining that the mode of existence of the flesh, the limited mode of existence of the flesh, that it's slavery to passions, to food, to the desire for pleasure, all of these passions that we experience, they saw as, of course, evil and therefore things that belonged to this lower world and were not supposed to be part of our spiritual relationship to God. And so some of these heretical communities start to absolutely repudiate marriage completely, that marriage is simply a bond of the body. It belongs to this created fleshly world that is in bondage to sin. It's in bondage to the limitations of the flesh and is doomed, of course, to pass away. And so they tried to kind of live the spiritual life, right, to repudiate the passions of their body and enforce kind of this spiritual eternal communion that they believed they had with the higher God, right? Gnostics were dualists who believed in two gods, the spiritual God above and simply the creator God, the God who is God of the body or a God of the flesh. And so, yeah, you did have certain communities that believe that the best way to bring this created world of slavery to an end was simply not to marry or to have children, right? And if everybody would cease to marry and have children, we would bring this created fallen world to its end, and it would begin kind of the spiritual world that is to come. And so, yeah, you had this emphasis in the church that then has to be dealt with by the church, and they are ultimately censured and repudiated, especially for their dualism. And certainly the goodness of marriage, the goodness of creation was upheld.
What was the Jovinian era you mentioned before?
Yeah, the Jovinian, it's a little bit of a mystery. I don't know that we know nearly as much about Jovinian because we really only know him from Jerome and some of Jerome's more extreme writings, you might say, against Jovinian. But what it seems like, one of the worst things that Jovinian, I think, said is he maintained that once you were baptized, you could never be overthrown by the devil, right? So baptism began this kind of perfect life in which you didn't really have to worry about doing battle with sin and the devil anymore. Now, because of that, one of the ways that manifested itself, it seems for him, is he basically repudiated any need for the ascetic discipline. So he started to say that many things that maybe on the surface we wouldn't disagree with, that the virginal life is no longer something we should strive for, you know, whether you marry or don't marry doesn't matter. Certainly fasting didn't matter anymore. So he kind of, because he rejected any more real battle with the devil and with sin that is raging in our hearts, he kind of therefore repudiated the need for any ascetic discipline at all. And of course, the church will finally reject that as well. I think, and not just in the, you know, Jerome kind of goes to an extreme, and many of your Orthodox Christians kind of didn't like how extreme Jerome got in terms of the way he reacted to it. But the church will reject that idea that there's no good to asceticism or ascetic discipline is not important, or that we're not engaged in a real battle with the devil, that in fact, as the baptized, we do have to worry about the devil seeking to overthrow us with temptation, and therefore the need to develop self-control and to direct our passions properly toward God was a fundamental importance. So, you know, those two extremes the church is going to reject, and I think in rejecting them both, always wants to maintain both the good of marriage as well as the good of the ascetic life.
Were there any attempts to ban the marriage of priests altogether?
Yeah, you do get one, you know, kind of significant moment. And of course, we don't have minutes from the Council of Nicaea, but the Council of Nicaea in 325, it does seem, according to Socrates, the historian, that there was some clergy, it seems, you know, a delegation of clergy there that wanted actually a ban on sacerdotal marriage or the marriage of priests, or we might say probably here the marriage after ordination. And, you know, significantly at Nicaea, that was rejected by the council. They, as the same will kind of come true again when, you know, as it comes to the schism between East and West, that this was an issue in the schism between East and West in the 11th century in 1054, in which, again, Gregory the Seventh, Pope Gregory the Seventh, wanted, again, a ban on all marriage after ordination. And it's precisely that the East will push back against that, right? And so, which gives you the more moderate position maybe of the Eastern churches, which we talked about a little bit earlier, that was more, I think, used to having married priests and practicing a more periodic continence. But then, of course, once that schism between East and West happens, I think it's at that point that the West is kind of free to enforce its own desire, which is going to be, first of all, the ban on any marriage after ordination that will then kind of develop over time into this kind of absolute celibacy.
So that picture there appears to be, if one is married beforehand, that doesn't bar them from becoming a priest. But right. If one is ordained a priest, then they were going to be discouraged to marry afterwards.
Right, and I think that's the major kind of prohibition, that you're going to get this, that once you're ordained, no marriage. So even in the Middle Ages, I think most of your priests probably were married beforehand. Then after ordination, probably at that point, then the West is starting to try to impose. And I think this is maybe the story of the medieval period, now the West is trying to now impose this absolute continence even on these married priests, right? So that the priest and his wife, he still takes care of his family and his wife, but they're no longer giving themselves to the sexual union. So this sense of kind of trying to now take the ideal, and I think that to me is maybe the transformation that's happening in the Middle Ages, that the virginal or celibate life is going from simply an ideal of the resurrection or of the kingdom to come, and now they're trying to enforce it in this world and in the here and now, and trying to make this into a kind of absolute commitment. You know, the motivations for that maybe are somewhat complex. At least one aspect of it is the attempt to maintain the authority of the clergy in the community at large. I think there's in some way absolute celibacy gave them a kind of cultural elitism in the community that allowed clergy to be seen and gave them a certain authority in their communities.
We're talking about the history of celibacy in the priesthood. Dr. James Buscher is our guest, Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can find out more about studying for the vocation of deaconess at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. When we come back, what was happening in the Middle Ages that hardened the rule on priestly celibacy?
Historians' ideological bias distorts or ignores evidence from the past, a bad kind of revisionism emerges.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College, talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
It masquerades as honest history. Such revisionism needs to be exposed and dismantled. It undermines proper understanding of our world. It has been said those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. In this case, failure to expose bad revisionism means that those who do not know the past are condemned to suffer at the hands of biased ideologues who claim they do.
You can meet and hear Dr. Mark Kaltoff making the case against revisionist history at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. EdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at EdGruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Holy Trinity Lutheran, Garfield, New Jersey. Grace Lutheran, Naples, Florida. St. John's Lutheran, Chicago, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Unionville, Michigan. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Beverly Hills, California. Epiphany Lutheran, Door, Michigan. The Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California. St. John's Lutheran, Sayville, New York. Apostles Lutheran, Melrose Park, Illinois. Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Elizabeth, Colorado. Grace Lutheran, Strasburg, Illinois. And Bethel Lutheran, Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back. We're talking about the history of celibacy and the priesthood with Dr. James Buescher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Another 10 minutes with him on this topic, then Carol Tobias, president of National Right to Life, will join us to respond to a column in Slate titled, "The Judicial Assault on Roe v. Wade Has Begun." Dr. Buescher, what happened in the Middle Ages that hardened the church's rule on priestly celibacy?
I guess I would point to a couple of things. I think one is certainly the sexual corruption of the clergy and the papacy in the 10th century, the 900s, which we don't have to go into detail about that, but it was, a very corrupt time publicly, sexually. In fact, it maybe is the first time maybe the term is used, the saeculum obscurum, the dark age, right, is that 10th century. And so there comes in the 11th century certainly desire to reform that, to kind of correct that corruption that had taken place and to regain the clergy's kind of authority in communities that they had lost, not unlike maybe today a little bit where the priesthood is certainly suffering because of the revelations of sexual abuse that have come among us. And certainly the same kind of thing there in the 10th century. So in the 11th century, you have these kind of reform movements in which they are trying to, again, become much more intentional about banning marriage after ordination and then even moving to an enforcement of absolute continence after ordination. That whole desire, that ban, receives new energy in this kind of reform movement. And it maybe then the second thing then is Pope Gregory VII, who proposes this ban. It becomes an issue in the schism, but you have the schism between East and West in 1054. And that does kind of free up, I think, in some sense, the West to not only, as both East and West did, hold up, the virginal life as the ideal, but now try to make that ideal the norm here in this world. And so you get the two Lateran councils of 1123 and 1129. Lateran simply refers to papal councils, the Lateran Palace in Rome. And so in those two councils, you're going to get this ban on no marriage after ordination. And after ordination, there's this absolute continence. And then we might point to just one other kind of factor, which is kind of an interesting one to me. As we move into the 13th century, you have a heretical group called the Albigensians, who basically took an extreme position that marriage is now sin. And so when the Western Church is rejecting Albigensian, they certainly develop much more the notion of marriage as holy and as a sacrament. All of those things start to get emphasized there. But one of the interesting things about that, maybe an ironic aspect of that, is what it meant is that they started to now no longer really desire to break up married priests. That is to say that the idea of having married priests who then get ordained and then have absolute continence, it was not found as desirable anymore to break up the sexual union of marriage. The idea of marriage as a holy, sacred estate, that bond is holy, meant that it's kind of irreversible. We should not be breaking it up with ordination. And so there becomes kind of the emphasis on now not only marriage, no marriage after ordination, but now no marriage before ordination. And so now you're going to start getting, coming out of the 13th century, the church enforcing the sense of single priests who have been virgins from the beginning and are dedicated now to this completely celibate life, which almost now moves celibacy into this a sense of just being incompatible in any sense with the married life.
It's a little bit of irony that in order to stop the practices of breaking up marriages after a man is ordained, they just decided they should have been celibate from the very beginning. They get this celibacy before and after by, ironically, wanting to uphold marriage.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of an interesting aspect of it, of just how that has developed and how kind of the energy that was behind the papacy and trying to enforce this kind of ideal. And I do think it's, rather than being so kind of theologically thought out, it seems to me to be a deeply cultural issue. The celibacy was very much tied up to the notion of the charism of the priest, to his authority, to the authority of the papacy, even over kings. Kings cannot control the sexual impulse, but the papacy can, right? So this kind of cultural sense that from celibacy, the church was getting a kind of authority in the community, and it served a bit of ecclesial elitism and the notion of a kind of hierarchical, supernatural kind of power that they possessed and that the priests could enact upon the earth. That seems to be kind of what was behind that and the energy behind that and to maintain that. I think that, too, is what they were trying to maintain against the Reformation, for instance, when the Lutherans and the Confessions pointed out the abuses of this issue in the church and how marriages were being broken up and, of course, priests weren't able to live up to this ideal and were pointing out those abuses in the Augsburg Confession, Article 23, as well as the Apology, that again, when you look at kind of the Council of Trent, how Rome responded to that, rather than to admit marriage, they again reassert celibacy as the mark of their authority, right? And this now becomes very much tied up with their status in the world and as possessing this supernatural authority to be enacted upon the earth through the papacy.
Did those two things kind of grow together then? This notion of the indelible character and, as we would probably refer to it, post-Reformation, and the notion of celibacy, did those two ideas about the priesthood kind of spur each other on?
Yeah, I think very much so. You know, there's much more reading I would have to do on this. I'm not by any means an expert on kind of all of this. You know, one of the first things I was going to say when I came on is that to talk about celibacy, I'm married and have three kids. So to kind of talk about celibacy is a bit of a stretch. And there's much more reading maybe to be done here and to be thought about. But I do think kind of recognizing the social aspects of celibacy and its importance kind of in the medieval church as a sign of their supernatural kind of character, that they were not just, they were no longer simply part of this created order, but they transcended it and had a bit more of an angelic character that could enact this kind of supernatural power in the world. Yeah, I think that's very much part of the worldview that stands behind this and certainly promoted kind of the notion of celibacy.
So by way of summary, it sounds like this is a issue that has a very long history in the Western Church, this notion of celibacy, but one that definitely was not in place from the time of the apostles or from Christ. How would you summarize what we've said so far today, kind of in a nutshell?
Yeah, I guess maybe the most fundamental thing is, to me, the lesson is to avoid these extremes. And I do think that's maybe what I would talk about in terms of the scriptural testimony and that of the early church is kind of recovering this balance between the married life as well as the virginal life as being mutually interdependent, as really supporting one another And, you know, when you go to extremes, that's when now marriage becomes a repudiation of virginity, and virginity becomes a repudiation of marriage, and they become mutually exclusive. And those are the extremes I think you have to worry about. I think in our culture, sometimes I wonder, at the same time that we often talk about marriage being repudiated and coming under fire and having great challenges to it, there's part of me that wonders if it isn't true of our culture that actually what's being rejected, perhaps more than even marriage, is virginity and the virginal life. Even the homosexual community desires marriage, right? And wants that reality. But think today of how, if you claim you're a virgin or if you maintain that, how laughed at you are and is seen as deficient and as living an unfulfilled life. And so I do think as a church to recognize the goodness of both of these estates is of crucial significance. And then I think the very emphasis that, you know, while virginity may in fact be the ideal and what life is in the resurrection, where we neither marry nor are given in marriage, nevertheless, we're not in that eschaton yet. The resurrection hasn't happened. We still live in a fallen world, and therefore we still need marriage. We still need it as a remedy to sin and as a way to support one another and curb our impulses, our desires for pleasure, and keep them directed in a righteous way as finding their fulfillment in God. So I think those are the lessons that I would emphasize out of this history.
Dr. James Buescher is Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Next time we'll talk with him about the issue of celibacy among the priests after the Reformation. Dr. Buescher, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Carol Tobias, President of National Right to Life, will be with us on the other side of the break. We're going to have her respond to a Slate column titled, "The Judicial Assault on Roe v. Wade Has Begun." Stay tuned.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, Coordinator for Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
You'll find real-life stories from women who have suffered miscarriage and infant loss in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Never Forsaken, God's Mercy in the Midst of Miscarriage. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or you can read an excerpt of Never Forsaken at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Never Forsaken, God's Mercy in the Midst of Miscarriage, 800-325-3040.
Hi, this is Pastor Dan Kistler of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Pacifica, California. A small congregation on the Pacific Coast just south of San Francisco, we invite you to join us as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation that He won for us on the cross and now delivers to us through His Word, baptism, and the Lord's Supper. For more information about us or for free downloadable sermons, visit our website at oursaviorspacifica.com. God's peace be with you always in our Savior, Jesus Christ.